Because the time is short, and because we can honestly say that Aldous Huxley needs no introduction, I'm not going to give him any. I understand we are going to get the talk originally, or part of the talk originally intended for last night. If Art Ross wants to make that climactic paragraph of his, he may do so. Otherwise, I think we'd better give all the time to Mr. Huxley. We're very glad to have you with us, and we appreciate your taking this time.
Well, may I suggest that this will at least mainly take the form of dialogue. So I don't think I may just start a thing and then to set it going. This whole question of what is a proper education, thank you, for freedom, seems to me to touch on a number of different fields. And I would think, first of all, that one of the fundamentals of such an education for freedom is the recognition of the fact and the inculcation of this fact. Children on every level, from a very small kindergarten almost upwards, of human uniqueness, the uniqueness of the individual, the differences as well as the resemblances between man, and the right of individuals of every kind to their particular kind of existence, the right to develop in their own way. I mean, this is surely the biological basis of all our ideas of freedom. I mean, if everybody were in fact the same, if one man's meat were not another man's poison, then really a single person at the top of the social pyramid would be in a position to dictate to all others what was good for them. But owing to the fact that we are profoundly different, then this sort of thing becomes oppression. And I think it is very important to build this kind of bridge between the biological facts and human values. It seems to me this is one of the gravest problems confronting all education now, that how do we build bridges between factual science and human values? But and wherever these bridges can be built, I think it's very important that they should be built. And here does seem to me a very important bridge, that the children can from the first be taught that they are different, that people have rights to be different, that within their own sphere of potentiality they can contribute as much as other types of children can contribute to the general whole, and that there is no valid reason for insisting that everybody should be cast in the same mold, should follow the same lines, should have the same taste. And to point out many experimenters are now pointing out, I mean, the Roger Williams, the University of Texas, has coined the phrase of biochemical individuality to indicate the fact that we are not only our faces are different, but the whole of our internal workings are different. And that this biochemical individuality obviously is related to a psychological individuality. And if this is drummed in from the first into the children, and with the sort of ethical and political corollaries which seem to rise from this, I feel that this is probably a very important basis for any education for freedom. Well, then it seems to me that this is one field in which a lot can be done. Then again, there's another very important field, which I would say is the linguistic field. After all, man is a symbol-making animal, and we exist like icebergs floating in immediate first order experience, but projecting up into the world of symbols, which is the essentially human world. But it also, unfortunately, is an all too human world. I mean, it is the fact that we are symbolic creatures living in the world of language and dominated by the world of language to a very great extent, which causes us so often to behave in manners much more devilish than any animal can behave, and much stupider. It permits us to behave in infinitely more intelligent ways and in more charitable ways than the animal, but it also permits us to behave in these other ways. I mean, after all, one can say, I think, that language, among other things, is a device for permitting human beings to do in cold blood what animals can do only in hot blood. It enables them to go on, for example, behaving in an angelically virtuous way because of their ideals, which keeps them going through thick and thin doing good. But it also enables them to behave in a completely diabolical way, which animals are quite incapable of. The life of animals is completely intermittent. They suddenly burst out. When you see two cats fighting, they will fight, and then suddenly they stop and start licking themselves, and then they may begin to fight again, or they may forget all about it. But the difference between animals and human beings is that animals have no system of principles and categorical imperatives which drive them on to continue either bad action or good action, whereas animals they lack this system, whereas human beings have this, and so can go on, as I say, doing in cold blood, both on the positive and the negative side, what the animal can do only when it is moved. And this, of course, the enormous power of words to make people do things and persist in action has been exploited by every dictator, and really now the means for doing this are greater than ever before. The technical means that more people can be influenced by one man at one time by means of our mass communication techniques than ever in the history of the world. And at the same time, a greater degree of knowledge of mind manipulation has been accumulated over recent years. And here again, it would seem to me that this is an important aspect of any education for freedom, is to teach children the principles of proper use of language, and then to this extent to make them at least partially immune to the allurements of the dictator, whose methods of propaganda are simply the methods of using language very effectively, but using it very badly. I mean, Hitler has explained in Mein Kampf very accurately of how this has to be done. Never consider any problem except dogmatically. There must never be anything but black and white. I am white, the other people are black. There is never any intermediate shade. The propaganda must always be couched in extremely simple terms, and then the whole art is this endless repetition of the same thing. And then there are, of course, other minor misuses of language which are very effective. And it does seem to me that if we are to have some degree of immunity to these terrifyingly powerful propaganda methods now at the disposal of men of bad will, then men of good will must provide young people in advance with some knowledge of what they're going to be exposed to, and some way of systematically criticizing the improper use of language. After all, I suppose one of the great intellectual achievements of the 20th century is in linguistic analysis. There has been a great deal of this, and it's remarkable how little this has, I think, penetrated into just ordinary education. But I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be adapted to quite early phases of education, so as to to give children a certain amount of immunity, as I say, to this. Well, then I think there is another aspect of education for freedom is the aspect, the kind of aspect of personal freedom, with the kind of aspect of it which was discussed, say, by the Stoics, or the kind of freedom which was aimed at by Oriental yogins. I mean, the Stoical idea of freedom was that you had to reach the state of ataraxia, of not being disturbed by the events of life, not allowing yourself to be carried away by passion. And to some extent this, of course, is the yogic idea. But the yogic idea is more practical, I think, inasmuch as they aim specifically at attacking the problem on the psychophysical level. That after all, the place where destiny approaches most nearly to us is our own autonomic nervous system. I mean, many people may be said to be the victims of their autonomic nervous system, which somehow gets out of hand and plays all kinds of tricks upon them. And in general, I would think that any system which helps the conscious mind to get onto good terms with the autonomic nervous system, and if possible to establish some measure of control over it, is a very good idea in relation to the problem of freedom. And people, I mean, for example, Professor Hornell Hart's book on auto-conditioning is an excellent summary of what can be done by remarkably simple means to attain a certain power of control over our responses, our reactions on the autonomic level, and so to make a better harmony between the ego and the various not selves within us. And I mean, in general, I think one can say that one of the great deficiencies of all the great ethical systems of the world has been to propose very good ideals, but not to offer effective means whereby these ideals can be implemented. I mean, as St. Paul says, that which I would not, that I do, and that which I would, that I do not. And this, of course, is the state of affairs of most people. But precisely this kind of self-training on the kind of level which is talked about by, say, Hornell Hart, or on the kind of level talked about by yoga, does seem to me a matter of considerable importance, that it does give one this kind of freedom from circumstances, which is another aspect of personal freedom, different from political freedom or civil liberty and so on, but nevertheless profoundly important. And needless to say, I don't think we can possibly adapt the extremely complex methods of yoga into any current system of education, nor do I see any particular point. I mean, I don't see any point in spending 5 years of one's life in order to learn how to reverse the peristalsis of the intestine, for example. There seems to be quite a good reason for example, controlling pain, which certainly can be done to a very considerable extent by techniques of auto-suggestion and so on. And again, as Hornell Hart has pointed out in his book, that it is possible by means of auto-suggestion to implement without such frightful difficulties as most of us find the good intentions that we make on New Year's Day every year and generally fail to carry out. So here seem to me three fields in the general educational field. Three fields in which something quite considerable can be done for the achievement of freedom on various levels. And the field of the recognition of human differences, the field of immediate control, and the field of language. If we can do something in these fields, I think we have struck a real blow and have probably have helped to make ourselves more secure in a world where the advance of technology and also, I think, at the same time, the advance in population and the advance in urbanization tend to exercise great pressures upon the individual, pushing him in the direction of becoming a cog in a great totalitarian machine. And is there anything that we can do to make the individual more secure against this this process of dehumanization, which I do think some aspects of advancing technology and certainly some aspects of increasing urbanization and population tend to impose upon society at large. Any method for resisting this and making people more autonomous is well worth looking into. I don't think we know the exact methods at present, but it seems to me that there is a very good case for considering these methods and seeing which of them can be applied to problems of children on every level, from the most rudimentary, from kindergarten upwards, and see how they can be applied most effectively. This was roughly the sort of lines I was going to talk about, but I brought that to move along.
Mr. Hasbeck, the problem that occurs to me most often in what I suppose is every teacher's attempt to stimulate a little of the desire, at least for intellectual freedom, is finding an answer to the paralyzing question, freedom for what? That I find find many students and others not really able to even to formulate that question, but this seems to be the tacit question. It seems that we have got to the point in society where so much is on the social level, and there are so many formal channels for activity that we have lost to a tremendous extent the ability to imagine what the individual could do with freedom if he had it.
Yes, I think this is a very important point. I mean, this is a point which this is why I like his psychological work so much. A.H. Maslow's work, his book, for example, Motivation and Personality, which where he talks about the self-actualized human being. He's one of the few psychologists who was really bothered to talk much about the totally healthy human being. Unfortunately, such a lot of psychology has sprung out of psychiatry. There's been a great tendency to concentrate on the unhealthy human being. And Maslow has done, I think, first-rate work here on the idea of the healthy human being, and has pointed out this sort of ultimate humanistic ideal of realizing human potentialities, which are very numerous, and many of which are not realized in point of fact, within the, in such a way, of course, it's not that everyone will realize as much of it as possible without doing harm to anyone else. This business about not understanding the point of freedom, I must say, I find very extraordinary, and I was very struck by it the other day. I was asked at the Menninger's to attend a group which one of the staff people was talking with, a group of nurses and aides and few young interns, and they, instead of, they were not, none of them were interns, they were the sort of hospital aides. Consequently, he didn't want to discuss individual case histories of patients he was treating. And he had thought of the rather interesting idea of discussing a case in fiction. And he'd given them the Brothers Karamazov to read. And then these are some very interesting cases to discuss from the psychiatric point of view. But what struck me profoundly, and I must say it alarmed me very much, he brought the conversation onto the great parable of the Grand Inquisitor. And he asked various members of this group about this. I mean, Freud has written actually on Dostoevsky and has stated at the beginning of his essay on Dostoevsky that he thinks the parable of the Great Inquisitor is one of the great mountain peaks of human ethical thought. And I was absolutely flabbergasted to listen to nurse after nurse and young man of orderly after orderly saying they didn't see couldn't see what the point of the story was, or they didn't really know what the point of this story of the Grand Inquisitor was. And finally I said, well, isn't it about the basic problem of freedom, versus security, the price of which is slavery? And oddly enough, I had this strange impression that this didn't ring any bell. It was as though they were perfectly prepared to accept the alternative presented by the Grand Inquisitor, who, you know, where he says that what the world really wants is, magic, miracles, and authority. Bread, miracles, and authority, isn't that it? I was left at the end. I remember talking with the man who was organizing the group. That seems to me absolutely terrifying. People don't see that this has a profound meaning and is of enormous importance, particularly in a world like ours, where there have been grand inquisitors like Hitler, and incidentally you can find quotations in Hitler which are almost identical with those of the Grand Inquisitor. I don't think he got it out of the Grand Inquisitor, but he said in one passage, history will regard me as the greatest liberator of humanity, inasmuch as I have liberated man from the appalling responsibility of being free. This is practically word for word what the Grand Inquisitor was saying, and I think Hitler probably quite sincerely believed this. But what really frightened me was to find a group of very nice, well-meaning, hard-working young men and women who didn't seem to feel that this was of a cardinal importance, and this seems to me rather to chime in with what you were saying.
Their work has become busy work rather than creative work. These orderlies and nurses are very busy. They're working and this is a sort of substitute for a replacement for genuine creative expression of the individual.
And of course, with the advance in the technicizing of all aspects of human life, I mean, I don't know if you know a book which I admire very, very much. I think it's the best book on technique, on the effects of technique in all spheres on human life that I know. It's by a Frenchman called Ellul. I don't think it's been translated into English. It's called La Technique. It's been translated into German, but it was published about 5 years ago, and I think it was the first great book. What he points out is that we're wrong to talk about merely the industrial revolution, that actually what we should talk about is the technical revolution, of which the industrial revolution is one manifestation. But this thing has been going on, the application of the ideas of technique and the sort of ruling idea of technique, of course, is the categorical imperative of being efficient, of doing the thing in the most purely rational way in the shortest possible time. And that, there is only one categorical imperative in regard to technique, which is efficiency, but after all, human beings probably have a good many categorical imperatives, of which efficiency ranks fairly low in the most ordinary human lives. And there is a real problem here of the subordination of human life to the purely technical life. I mean, it is, one can say, I mean, in the advance of technology, a seed has been planted, and this seed continues to grow according to the laws of its own being. But the laws of the being of applied science and technology are not necessarily the laws of human being. And the question is, shall the human being be subordinated to this, or shall this be subordinated to the human life? And Eliel brings out a point which I think is very important too. He says that what he feels is the fundamental difference between the Russian and the Western system is not so much now ideological and economic. It is in the sphere of technology. The Russian sacred books, especially Engels, insisted that technology was always good. I mean, it was always admirable. The more technology you had, the more you were advancing towards this new Jerusalem. And this is a sort of basic tenet of the Russian system. Whereas in the West, he says, we still remember Christianity, we still remember Jefferson. And when we have to make a choice, we always do so with considerable hesitation. I mean, however, it is always rather like that line in Byron's Don Juan, where he says, "And vowing she would ne'er consent, consented." We always vow that we will ne'er consent, but in practice we always do consent after a certain time. And that, but we resist a bit. The Russians do not resist at all the logical implications of advancing technology, whereas we do, and therefore to some extent we may appear to be less efficient than the Russians. But Eliel's idea is that we are all being pushed in the same direction by the advancing technicization of every aspect of life, not merely on the mechanical level, but also on the organizational level, and now it's been able to get into the psychological and physiological levels. So that here we obviously do have here an immense problem in regard to freedom. I mean, here are great forces which are clearly antagonistic to all the values that we've set on in relation to freedom and democratic institutions, and can we by educational methods offset these impersonal forces which are shoving us towards this termite-like organization, and can we by taking proper thought make the best of both worlds, which is to get all the advantages of the technical world without having to pay too highly in the loss of spontaneity and the power of freedom. It seems to me to be one of the great problems confronting us now.
I'm glad you said that in the last part of your statement, because it seems to me that otherwise too often people suppose that human freedom and advancing technology are necessarily opposed. It would seem to me very definitely the case that, I would say, for instance, most men today are far freer than they were in the 17th or 18th centuries, precisely due to the fact that we have technological advance.
Oh, I would agree. We have to make sure that this is not going to swallow us up.
I mean, I would think that you'd have to have both empathies, wouldn't you, at the same time?
Mm.
Huxley, do you feel that the threat of atomic annihilation will induce a sort of tragic note into American thinking about the moon of America, or maybe somewhat more romantic, idealist character?
I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that there are two ways of reacting to this kind of overwhelming threat. I mean, either to react in what may be called a tragical, realistic way, or else the way of sort of reacting by a kind of irrelevance. I mean, one sometimes sees this, for example, a cat which is playing with a mouse, but the mouse isn't dead, but it's still sort of running about. The mouse seems sometimes to reach a point where it doesn't make any further effort to act in a realistic way. It will suddenly start sort of grooming its whiskers and in an entirely inappropriate manner. I mean, it makes no attempt to escape or do anything about its situation any longer. And I think something comparable may happen in very desperate human situations. When a thing becomes too desperate, then that a kind of indifference may set in, and people will just do something beside the point, which is just amuses them for the time being. Now, I think this is there are these two manners of reacting to a tremendous threat, and it is obviously very important that we should take the tragic, realistic road rather than the inappropriate, beside the point road.
Would you say that in some respects the mystic is something like a mouse who rules his whiskers?
No, because he doesn't necessarily escape from the world. I mean, I think the mystic, I mean, all the great mystics have insisted to have to, I mean, what you take in contemplation you give out in charity. But I think what he has done is to apply to himself the third class of the education for freedom, which I was talking about, in a very advanced state. I mean, that he is to a large extent immune to the shocks of fate and of his own internal disturbances. But, I mean, if he is the right kind of mystic, he certainly doesn't try to escape from the world. He tries to make use of his increased power, because he is not, so to speak, getting into his own life, to do better things for his fellows. I mean, I think that, you know, naturally the type of what I would call false mystic who does behave like the mouse brushing its whiskers and getting right outside reality. But I don't think, I mean, this would not be approved of by any of the great people in the great men in the mystical tradition.
Well, what would you say of a man who said that his notion of the ideal adjustment to the world would be to be ever more dependent upon external fact for his satisfactions or not? I should think that if a person was not insulated against sorrows and difficulties and griefs and so forth, he might make more objective efforts to correct the objective facts which were wrong, rather than if he were, in fact, insulated.
Well, again, I mean, that seems to me as in all, I mean, the whole problem of human life, my mind, is to make the best of both worlds, and then it's not a question of both worlds, because after all, we inhabit a great many worlds. To make the best of all of the worlds, owing to our strange amphibian nature, we do live in. And if this complete indifference were, I think what one sees here, and what the difference where, it's very interesting to read some of the utterances of the people who found mystical experiences about practical problems. I always remember a fascinating story about St. Ignatius Loyola,
Indeed, after all, he had a very, very profound mystical experience which influenced the whole of his life. At the time when it seemed very unlikely that the popes would approve of the continued existence of the order, somebody asked him, what would you do if His Holiness were to dissolve the order? And Ignatius replied, 15 minutes of private orison and I would think no more about it. But which nevertheless did not prevent him, from working very strenuously in one field or another for what he regarded as the benefit of his fellow beings. And I suppose the ideal then is that somebody is free from the assaults of circumstances in himself, but is terribly concerned about the assaults of circumstances on other people. That he accepts for himself, but does not accept for other people.
Wouldn't you say, though, that the general tendency is for a person who is insulate himself from sorrow also to be insulated about the assaults of others? I'm not sure at all that I would agree that most mystics are. And you might take this example, the one about Loyola. Someone might say that he ought to be more concerned about the abolition of his order if it really was doing good.
Well, he would accept this as the will of God at that moment. I mean, it was particularly easy because it was coming from the Pope, they would have no difficulty in it.
But isn't this just the objection to that sort of...
Well, no, he would then, presumably, he would have gone on in some other method which would be more acceptable. I mean, I don't think it would have paralyzed him or made him retire from the world in any way.
One other thing I'd like to ask. Just let me ask. Do you believe that there is, on the basis of a mystic experience, that this is a way of getting knowledge about anything other than the individual who has the experience? Anything else?
Certainly not a way of getting knowledge about how to make sulfuric acid or something of this kind. But it may be a way. I mean, there's a very peculiar phrase which is used in the Western tradition, that this is a source of obscure knowledge. It seems to be a source of knowledge not in detail, but knowledge about the nature of things at large. I mean, the knowledge being that there is a kind of solidarity of the universe and that we can become solidary with it. I mean, this would be the obscure knowledge, which is not at all, you see, knowledge about the future or knowledge about any individual fact here and now, which would then have just to be worked out in the ordinary way.
You mentioned linguistic analysis as being a desirable thing. A linguistic analyst would very much be disturbed by identifying what you're describing as obscure knowledge with other forms of knowledge.
Well, yeah, I quite agree, but then, I mean, again, I think we have to make the best of both worlds of linguistic analysis and other things. I mean, the logical positivists say many things are meaningless, many questions are meaningless, which nevertheless remain very important questions. I think Bertrand Russell has pointed this out, that although from a logical positive point of view, questions as whether the soul is immortal or not may be meaningless, this question does remain in some form or another rather an important one. And I think, I mean, here again, one has somehow to carry this to the point where it makes sense, and then to admit that, after all, the basis of all our, even of the most ordinary knowledge, is a non-rational fact. I mean, nothing could be less explicable from a rational point of view, you know, the fact that we see colored patches and the kind of world we find we live in. I mean, it's just one of those themes. I mean, we just have to accept it whether we like it or not. I mean, remember what Carlyle said about Margaret Fuller when she was told that she's come to accept the universe, and she said, by God, you damn well better. I mean, there is no other... we have to accept these non-rational
facts. Well, may I ask this question, Mr. Huxley? Isn't that just the danger that you were talking about before? If everything remains on a level of private experience, aren't we really at a danger to answer the kind of question that Dr. Hutchinson was asking, freedom to do what? Now, it seems to me we should have some public, independent way of judging the validity or some way verifying the nature of these kinds of experiences that these people have. I don't think it's true to say that some of the things that you were talking about before will be placed into the same realm as to why we see color, because there are all kinds of scientists, both within biology and psychology and physics, trying to find out some of the factors involved in the perception of color. And in the area of psychology, there are many scientists, both within psychology and outside of psychology, trying to arrive at objectively separating criteria for the validity and the quality of these various kinds of experiences. I don't think we can lump the experience of a man on the alcohol, with dope, and some of these other things, and the schizophrenic, and say that they are all the same kinds of mystical experiences.
No, they're not.
I don't think we have to accept them for what they are. There are ways, I think, that we have to try to arrive at a public science of these things. Otherwise, you're going to deny any scientific investigation of human beings' behavior at all.
Why not? Why assume that nothing is going to be important that cannot be scientifically demonstrated?
No, I did not say it's not important. These are important questions, but how are we going to resolve these questions? Are we going to do it by saying, look, buddy, what's in your mind is equally good as what's in the mind of somebody else, and therefore there's no objective way that we can arrive at the validity of whatever comes out of people's minds? This is the very common danger that led to all these other inquisitors that we spoke about, like Hitler, like the idealists. These people put themselves up as little gods. They knew how to manipulate people, and there was really no way to challenge them.
There
must be some way, isn't there, that we should be able to challenge the validity of
challenge the validity of Hitler, because we know that people do vary very greatly among one another individually, and that Hitler was flying in the face of biological fact, actually. But I mean, take this question of, how do we demonstrate the validity of getting an extraordinarily pleasurable and more than pleasurable experience out of great music? I mean, the aesthetic experience seems to be one of the, it has the nature of an absolute value, as far as I can see. It's not instrumental to anything else. It has no biological value, as far as I can judge. But I mean, aren't there certain things which are, one just has to take as such, given absolute values? I don't know, it seems to me.
This may be so, but I was talking about some of the other things we've been talking about, namely that certain saints or certain other kinds of individuals have claimed to have had certain kinds of experiences which in certain cases have had rather profound influences on their lives and somebody else's lives. Now, can one distinguish between whether, quote, these individuals were really attaining knowledge from some being or whether they were in fact hallucinating? I have to make some decision myself about whether I'm going to accept what these people tell me. I happen to be a psychologist, by the way, and I hear this twice a week now in a mental hospital. Now, what's the difference between what these people are telling me and some of these other experiences? I'm not irreligious, I want to add that too. But I want to get some way of assessing when somebody is talking about some reality, or whether this is just the vagaries of his own mind, which might happen if he were getting DTs.
I quite agree. This has been discussed by people like James and others. One of the ways is undoubtedly the fruits of these things. I mean, if the
fruits are obviously as unsatisfactory as they are of people who have been put into a mental institution, then I think one is pretty sure saying that these things, although they may have some elements of value in them, must have elements of, many elements of negative value. But on the other hand, if the fruits are obviously extremely precious to human beings at large, I mean, then I think there is a presumption that this does correspond with some kind of reality which we have no idea what it does. Correspond, may correspond with something simply which is at the back of all human minds.
Doesn't James say, though, too, that we can accept the fact that people do have such mystic experiences without accepting their interpretation of
well, well, exactly. I mean, I think this is quite true. And I mean, there again, within the Christian tradition, there are all kinds of difficulties in regard to the pure mystical experience. I mean, they're one of the most interesting mystical writers of the present century is Abbot John Chapman writes saying that in one of his letters he says that the Christianity is like a sponge, mysticism is like a sponge which in the West is full of Christianity. It is possible to squeeze out all the Christianity and the sponge remains in its full structure. And he says that consequently it is extremely difficult for us as Christians to find a complete reconciliation between the two, because the two can exist quite apart from one another. He himself was profoundly mystic. He never finally resolved this question, as far as I can see, in his own mind. I mean, he just said the two existed and the sponge was frequently filled with Christian material, but it didn't have to be.
Well, what I would be getting at is this. Why couldn't you say that we could give naturalistic explanations of mystical experiences in the way I suppose we do of hallucinations or other forms of psychic disorders without crediting the mystic's report of what he has experienced as telling us anything other than something about the mystic himself? In other words, not saying that this is evidence for any fact or truth or anything else apart from that particular individual.
Well, I mean, I think you can have a naturalistic interpretation, which will go so far as to say that this is a characteristic of the human mind, and this is from personal experience of many people, this is an immensely precious characteristic of the human mind. I mean, I think this is something which you can have a purely humanistic interpretation of mysticism and probably get almost all the values out of it that that those who, with a theistic explanation have had. And of course, I mean, I thought within Buddhism you don't have a theistic explanation at all. I mean, you merely postulate some sort of general underlying substratum of mind, and what James himself called cosmic consciousness, I suppose. But of course, the whole Buddhist philosophy, I mean, anticipates Feuerbach by about 2,000 years. And so that all gods are projections of the human mind. And the human mind then is a manifestation of mind in general, so to say.
Well, now, there's just one other thing, and that is, you said that you thought in general the true mystic was one who was concerned with the rectification of external circumstances. And that was part of his experience. I'm interested to compare that with the statement in the lecture last night about the poor boxes and the stained glass windows.
Well, these were not necessarily enlightened persons who put the money in. I mean, they were going to enjoy themselves very much with And they did put some into the poor box, let's say. But the poor boxes were less full, apparently. That's what, anyhow, the abbot's sujet in the 11th century, 12th century, said.
Well, it's just for, I suppose I'm too much on one side, but I would say that I far prefer full poor boxes and not so full
Well, I mean,
we have to have a limited amount of funds for either.
Well, I mean, we have to have, I mean, this aesthetic and beyond the aesthetic, these sort of other experiences. I mean, the aesthetic is obviously a kind of analog and even a homolog of these other experiences, and they're obviously a first-class value. I mean, the needless to say, the immediate humanitarian value is at least equal. But I mean, the aesthetic value remains. I mean, the good, the true, and the beautiful, and this has immemorially been one of the fundamental values of the human race. And I mean, this seems to me to be quite a realistic appraisal of what the human mind does develop into, provided the immediate satisfactions, biological satisfactions, are given, then these other needs can be felt and to some extent satisfied. I mean, this is, seems to me, one of the reasons why it's extremely important to have the best possible kind of environment, because only under those circumstances can these higher human needs manifest themselves and a fortiori be satisfied. As long as the fundamental biological needs and also the fundamental psychological needs remain unsatisfied, then it's extremely unlikely that these higher needs for knowledge and for beauty will even be felt, much less satisfied. I mean, there is, I think, I mean, when you look at the sort of hierarchy of human needs, you do see that, again, this does present a very good argument for having a decent and a free society.
Oh, I would agree that it might be important. It would be probably would be very desirable if we could fill both boxes.
Yes.
But I just would think that the one ought to be filled first.
Well, yes. I mean, but as I say, I think probably the St. Francis of Assisi would have filled the poor box first. But these were not St. Francis of Assisi. But then they were getting a tremendous aesthetic and kind of visionary value out of these extraordinary works of art, and I must say to this day they remain very extraordinary. I cannot go into one of these great 12th or 13th century cathedrals to see a lot of glass without being absolutely overpowered by this extraordinary visionary art which was developed at this time.
I wonder, Lost Gordon, if you haven't shifted grounds here though, how do you justify this preference in terms of what you started with?
What do you mean what I started with?
Your decision, your choice of filling poor boxes first.
This well, I know about that. Yes, but I mean, I think if the poor boxes are not filled enough, then they can't even enjoy the stained glass windows.
Yeah, well, I quite agree.
I mean, until the belly is full, the soul can really hardly function, can it? I mean, man cannot live by bread alone, but he certainly can't live without it. And
of course, the poor boxes fill other people's bellies, and I wonder whether the appreciation of the stained glass windows isn't perhaps a necessary antecedent before you can begin to take an interest in filling not only your own belly but someone else's.
Well, I think this may be a very interesting point, that I mean that you. Again, to quote what Eckhart says, that what is taken in by contemplation is given out in charity, that the realization of the complete solidarity of the human race with one another and perhaps with the cosmos at large is the kind of end product of this contemplative and visionary thing, and that the feeling of the need to feel that to fill the poor boxes may become stronger then. I think you may be right in this respect. Or, but
you think that's historically true, though?
Well, of course, a great many people, very few people have, I think, actually gone right through to the end.
I recall, for example, in Italy, going to see these beautiful cathedrals with these gorgeous ornamented altars, some ones I mentioned you had in mind last night, and walking through areas of abject poverty to get there.
Oh my God, I mean, I was 2 years ago. Goodness, I've never seen anything like it in Europe, in Palermo. Possibly the worst slum in Palermo lies between the cathedral and the Palace of Justice. Between them, I mean, there are about 30 acres of the most indescribable squalor. And this capacity of human beings to live in that totally watertight world is so extraordinary. I mean, of course, when you see the cathedral, you're reminded so strongly of Samuel Butler's musical Banks, remembering Erewhon. I mean, this extraordinary thing which goes on, the money which is put in, which is not real money, which will not buy anything at all in the outside world. But you pay the check in, you take it out, and you put it in somewhere else. I think that whole description in Butler is an absolute masterpiece of this. This capacity of what are possibly immensely important ways of approaching the life of human life becoming absolutely irrelevant, which quite clearly in much institutionalized religion they have become, although by no means always.
You see, my problem as far as knowledge is concerned is that one of the characteristics that I think of as attaching to that word, and of course it's a matter of really arbitrary matter, which what you decide to attach to it, is public verification.
Yes, but I think you have to make some kind of distinction between knowledge in terms of symbols which can be applied to particular repeatable experiments, and a kind of, intuition is such a bad word now, nevertheless, one has to use this slightly obscene word, the kind of intuitive understanding of oneself, of other human beings, of our relationship with one another and with the world as a whole.
And I have not discovered that sort of knowledge that is not verifiable and very reliable as far as making any prediction or making any judgment at all about any future events or anything else. But I have found that knowledge that does have come in public verifiable form to be rather reliable.
Yes, but I mean, don't we have to have, to make this public scientific knowledge valuable. I mean, this is the whole problem, isn't it, of love and intelligence. I mean, love without organized intelligence, which is knowledge, is apt to be impotent. And knowledge without pure intelligence and intellect, matter of practice, divorce pure knowledge from the aesthetic sense, from the emotional feelings of goodwill and so on. Otherwise, it does become. You then have this danger of humans who are, after all, much more than machines for acquiring pure verifiable knowledge. I mean, they have a great many other aspects as well. But if you concentrate too exclusively on pure verifiable knowledge, then you're in danger of neglecting these other sides of human nature, which certainly require to be thought about and which have intrinsically very great values. I mean, it seems to me you have to keep alive this other side.
Well, what's the purpose in calling them both knowledge?
Well, I wouldn't perhaps call them knowledge. I mean, the fact that Western tradition happens to be called obscure knowledge, and this is all, but I think I would call it maybe direct understanding or direct intuition into the nature of deepest self, and it's possibly the world at large. No, I agree. There's a good argument in not using the word knowledge here, or to use it in some slightly qualified sense.
Don, to revert to an earlier point, aren't we in danger domestically of overflowing the poor box at the expense of the stained glass window?
In America? Yeah. Possibly. Certainly not in the world.
No, I purposely said domestically.
Yeah. Well, not enough poor boxes and too many poor. I mean, it's sort of...
I meant the emphasis on what our material needs are. I think we're in danger of going too much in the direction of satisfying.
I'm wondering if in Don's judgment there wasn't something else. It's not just the fact that there are the poor who have material need. There is also a judgment here that there's something wrong with the man who will put his money in the stained glass window box and not in the portrait. It's, after all, a blindness in this man to moral values and a concentration on his other values. So it's more than just a matter of choice between the material and the higher.
And this gets
a choice between two higher values.
The stained glass window is a selfish.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what Mr. Huxley said last night.
Yeah.
They get more out of the stained glass windows than out of the portal.
Yeah.
And yet, a world without stained glass windows would be a very impoverished world.
Oh, right.
Yeah. We all agree to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We agree to that too.
Well, the story of Mary and Martha and the anointing of Jesus' feet, I think, is very relevant to this. Should the oil be used to anoint Jesus' feet, or should it be used for the poor? Should the money that it represents, this is the stained glass window, is against the poor box.
Yes, but the answering, giving the oil to Jesus' feet is what brought Hitler and Mussolini into being, which destroyed all aesthetic values, so I don't think that's very valid.
Well, this may be, but this means we better reject the New Testament.
No, I don't think that means that at all.
It's just what?
One thing.
Well, just this one time, you should.
Perhaps the mysticism and not the social ethic.
Well, I
doubt if we have to make an absolute choice, really, can't we?
No.
Well, you can. I keep saying
you can get your aesthetic values without all those.
All that I would be contending for, I think, is that I happen to believe that historically, and maybe this is an error, that many times when people have taken the mystic way, they have done this at the expense of concern with the poor boxes. And where this has happened, seems to me this is highly undesirable. The one says that, and that I also do not like the identification of even knowledge in both the...
Well, I agree. I mean, I would like to find another word. I mean, to...
What about appreciation? Would that
appreciation,
do?
Yes, or
well,
direct acquaintance, I don't know what.
Well, if you, I think your dichotomy is to not exclusive enough, because what you have here is not only social justice versus mysticism, but social justice versus aesthetic, too.
Mm-hmm. I would say that I think the poor boxes are more important than the stained glass window.
And now I think you should establish you should substantiate your judgment that
the one
you
can
historically this is characteristic. There, it seems to me that history refutes you completely, and that the higher in the scale of the mystical experience the individual is, the more he has contributed to the poor boxes. Who has contributed more to the poor boxes than Jesus? Or than Gautama Buddha.
Let's not take Jesus.
I don't think that you can say at all that the mystical experience in general makes the individual indifferent. It seems to me that all our major impulses to fill the four boxes have come ultimately from the mystics. They certainly haven't come from science. They certainly haven't come from any other
things.
Who wants to fill it? Why do you want to fill the poor box? Where do you get that feeling that the poor box ought to be filled from, if not from, ultimately, from the mystical experience?
Well, this is